I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Coming up, what we can learn about combating climate change from the response to the COVID-19 crisis. Our guest is environmental scientist Michael Mann. President Trump has made getting rid of environmental policies a centerpiece of his administration. In recent weeks, while the pandemic has closed down much of the country and much of the government, EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler has been working to roll back rules and regulations related to fuel standards, gas and oil drilling, coal-fired power plants, and research. We asked Rebecca Lieber to join us, and she covers environmental politics and policy for Mother Jones. And Rebecca, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
So is the administration fast-tracking these deregulation actions?
Right. We're seeing a continuation of this policy that's been going on since the start of the Trump administration to roll back Obama-era climate rules. We've actually had some of the biggest rollbacks yet happen in the last few weeks during this pandemic. But it's important to remember that one of the reasons this is happening all now is the Trump administration faces a deadline around May to roll back as many rules as possible to avoid easy reversal by the next Congress.
So Congress has the ability to roll some of this back, and this is the Congressional Review Act?
That's right. The Congressional Review Act lets Congress roll back or reverse regulations that take place in the final days of Congress, which for this session, it would probably be May. And it lets Congress reverse the administration by a simple majority. So this is counting on a change of administration in the 2020 election and probably Democrats gaining some kind of majority in Congress. But Trump, of course, wants to avoid having his legacy erased. This was certainly a tool that was used to reverse several Obama rules. And Trump is racing against this deadline of May to avoid CRA being a tool that Democrats could use.
And CRA has been around for a number of years, correct?
Right. It's a law that was passed in 1995 that is used very rarely, but was used quite a bit for Obama's rules when Trump first came in. So I think we've seen a precedent that it's becoming more common.
Well, let's talk about some of these rollbacks or proposed rollbacks, one aimed at car and light truck pollution. What is the Obama administration, what do they want to do on this?
Well, Trump has essentially eased Obama's regulations on fuel efficiency standards for cars. So what Trump has done is introduce a new rule that only requires automakers to reach about 1.5% fuel efficiency gains every year by 2025. Now, the Obama rule had gains of 5%, and those percentage points might not sound like a lot, but it adds up to a huge amount in public health savings and also savings for the economy. So these are what we're talking about is tailpipe emissions from cars, and this is a giant source of carbon pollution for the U.S. This transportation has overtaken the power sector as our number one polluter for climate change. And targeting the auto sector to have cleaner cars is seen as a huge step towards combating climate change. So in effect, Trump is unwinding Obama's most significant legacy on climate.
And our auto industry, is the auto industry calling for this? Do they want the Trump administration to do this?
This is where it gets complicated. The auto industry and the domestic auto industry did request relief from the Trump administration early on, saying
but
that
you mean the Obama administration? The Obama administration wanted relief from the Obama administration?
Well, some in the auto industry were against the rule from the Obama administration.
Okay.
And when Trump came in, he actually went further than many companies even wanted here. There's been some interesting letters from companies representing most of the domestic industry asking for more certainty from the Trump administration, because he's gone so far in rolling back these standards that he's going beyond that the auto industry is actually expected to gain more in fuel efficiency than these rules even require. Industries like some level of regulatory certainty so they can plan for the future. And the Trump rule really throws that into chaos. And in the end, by the administration's own estimates, this rule that they've unveiled actually would cost the American economy between $13 billion and $22 billion. And that's because Americans would have to spend more at the gas pump, and there's public health costs as well.
Even though they call it safer, and I'm quoting here, safer, affordable, fuel-efficient vehicles. Correct?
Right, yeah. I think the rules have all kinds of names. It's usually not a good indicator of what's actually in them.
There are also efforts to open public lands for gas and oil drilling. Where does that stand?
Now, this is an effort that the Department of Interior has continued for years now, holding quarterly sales for public lands to fossil fuel leases. That's continued during the pandemic, which is really interesting because this is another area where the Trump administration can cement its legacy, because once the land is leased, there's not much that a future administration can do about those leases. So Interior has continued those leases even during the pandemic, at the same time that other parts of the government have said that it's going to be impossible to do their normal jobs of enforcement and accountability for polluters. But it's interesting that the parts of the government that have continued their work are the ones that promote fossil fuel production, while we're seeing parts of the EPA that enforce the law, that ensure compliance for companies, those have stepped back in the middle of this pandemic.
It'd be interesting to see whether companies actually do want to drill on public lands, because we know, at least as it stands now, there's a glut of fossil fuels on the market. It's not particularly profitable. And I wonder whether economics might do what environmental regulations could not do.
That's true that there would be less interest in drilling on the lands. But one thing that happens when the administration has opened up an excessive amount of land to industry is the government isn't getting a good return on its dollar for leases. And that's because the leases themselves are pretty heavily subsidized. They can just cost dollars for a company for acres of land. And by opening up more land, even when there's far less demand from the industry to produce, taxpayers in the end could get an even worse deal on those leases.
How about rolling back coal-fired power plants? This has been a longstanding issue within the Trump administration, trying to roll back some Obama-era regulations.
Yeah, another piece of the Obama administration's legacy on climate was regulating carbon pollution from new and existing power plants. And this is where we're talking about coal and the transition to cleaner fuels. The Trump administration has also targeted this and rolled those regulations back. But there's also other rules that target the coal industry that are just as important for cleaning up the power sector. And one of them that environmentalists expect to come in the near future is targeting mercury pollution from power plants. And this is mercury that comes from the smokestack and is heavily found in coal-fired power plants. So the mercury rule, along with several others, have forced the power sector to clean up, and it actually has helped spur some of these power plant shutdowns that we've seen, hundreds shut down from the start of the Obama administration to now. And all these rules together, the Trump administration, in trying to roll them back, has hoped to save the coal power sector. But all the economic trends, like you said, they reign over the deregulation. And we have actually seen those plants continue to shut down at about the same pace as the Obama era.
A couple of more things before we have to say goodbye. One is an EPA letter that was sent to a number of all governmental agencies and even the private sector. What did this letter say?
This was a really remarkable letter that we got a few weeks ago, backdating to March 13th, that tells the industries that EPA regulates that it would have a lot more relief during this pandemic, meaning the EPA will not hold accountable companies that stop monitoring their pollution, that stop reporting to the EPA their pollution. And in some cases, by the EPA's own admission, even if it applies very broadly and they might not be punished, even if it creates an acute risk or imminent threat to human health or the environment. This letter is unprecedented. Of course, we're in unprecedented times, but former EPA staff reacted very strongly to this, saying this is an open license to pollute by telling industry that you're not expecting the same kind of reporting and accountability that you are. The EPA has basically given them permission to break the law. And of course, we are fighting a crisis that revolves around a respiratory illness, and pollution itself causes respiratory problems. So there's quite a close link here to the health effects from environmental rollbacks and the actual crisis that we're facing now.
And about a minute before we have to say goodbye, your most recent story is about the plastic industry, basically saying plastic bags, this is their message, I guess, to consumers, is plastic bags don't spread COVID virus. In fact, I was at my local supermarket and they said I couldn't use my reusable bags. I used paper, but nonetheless, there was all that plastic.
Thanks. Yeah, this is, I think, another important trend happening now where the plastics industry has had this very long held campaign against reusable bags, where they've claimed everything from reusable bags are dirtier to they're less efficient for people. And what we've seen happen since the start of the pandemic in the U.S. is the plastics industry has shifted that message to adapt for COVID-19, basing on some questionable science to claim that reusable bags help to spread the virus. And we don't have a ton of information about specifically reusable bags. Some experts I talked to questioned whether that was really the case. And we're just seeing industries take advantage of this crisis we're in to continue this long health campaign. So you're seeing more bans on reusable.
I hear you. Got to leave it there. Rebecca Lieber, thank you so much for joining us. And she covers environmental politics and policy. Coming up, scientist Michael Mann.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The coronavirus pandemic has closed down large parts of the global economy. Factories and businesses are shuttered. The public has been told to stay home. Streets and highways are mostly traffic-free. One of the side effects of reaction to the threat of COVID-19, cities that had been shrouded in smog now have clear blue skies. And while that reveals how human activities can change the environment in the short term, the impact of climate change on the planet has not slowed. So what can we learn about our reaction to this lethal virus that can be applied to mitigating the effects of CO2 emissions on the environment? We asked Michael Mann to join our conversation. He's a professor of atmospheric science and director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, the author of a number of books. He's got a new one coming out called How to Win the New Climate War. Michael Mann, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's great to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, you can join our conversation, Radio Times. Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always leave a comment on our Facebook page as well. I'm sure, like you, I was looking at pictures of LA before and after the pandemic, New Delhi before and after the pandemic. And we do see with our naked eyes at least the short-term impact of what happens when you take cars off the road.
Yeah, that's right. And not just cars off the road, but much less air travel right now. This is propagating through our entire economy. And what we're seeing is that there is currently a relationship between economic activity and the generation of pollution, including carbon pollution. So if you slow down economic activity, you're going to slow down carbon emissions and other pollutants. Now, of course, that presents a real challenge because we do all need to continue on with our lives. We need resources to carry out our daily activities. We can't allow the global economy to come to a screeching halt. And so ultimately the challenge is for us to continue to move forward, to continue to maintain the health of our economy and not generate pollution, including carbon pollution, at the same time. We need to decarbonize our economy. And there are so many lessons that we can take away from this episode, this latest crisis, this acute crisis, there's so many lessons that we can take away when it comes to the even larger challenge of averting catastrophic climate change. And I hope we take away the right lessons. But one of the lessons that we actually do draw from this experience is that simply slowing down the economy, ceasing air travel, less transportation, these individual actions have a limit in how much they can accomplish when it comes to reducing carbon emissions. The estimates right now are that the pandemic is probably going to decrease carbon emissions by about 4%.
Is that a lot? Okay. Is that a lot in the big scheme of things?
We need to decrease them by 50%. We need to bring them down by a factor of 2 by the end of this decade if we're to stay on a path that averts catastrophic 2 degrees Celsius, 3.5 degree Fahrenheit warming. We need to bring those carbon emissions down to net zero by mid-century, by 2050. And all of this, what seems like a sudden and dramatic change in our lifestyles, that only led to 4% of a decrease in carbon emissions. And what that tells us is that individual actions alone aren't going to be enough. We do need a fundamental transformation of our economy. We need to decarbonize our economy. We need to take advantage of new carbon-free technology for generating energy. There are going to need to be major structural changes if we are going to accomplish the fairly monumental reductions in carbon emissions that we need to. Not flying and other personal actions like we're seeing right now, it's just not enough.
And I do want to get to all of that, but I'm also interested in your thoughts about what we are learning, certainly about COVID-19, but other viruses that really have come from loss of habitat, which we are observing. And we're seeing that with the loss of habitat, it's easier for pathogens to spread among wildlife and then from wildlife jumping over to humans. When you look at COVID-19, and the theory is that it certainly came from an animal, probably came to some degree from destruction of some kind of forests, that this is the present, but also the future if we don't address this problem.
Yeah, that's right. Just another lesson, and there are so many to take away from this pandemic. And the lesson here is that there is a cost when it comes to the destruction of our environment, and sometimes those costs are not immediately apparent, but they can be quite acute, as we see with this pandemic. Ultimately, the increase in certain types of infectious disease are tied to the destruction of habitat. The world's leading ecologists have very affirmatively made that connection. And there's sort of an interesting philosophical undergirding to this, if you will, which is sort of steeped in the theory of Gaia. And I'm not sure if you or your
I remember
listeners.
That theory. Yeah.
and it's basically a theory. It was put forward by two great scientists, James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis, who's no longer with us, unfortunately. And it posits that the Earth system essentially behaves, in a sense, like a living organism. And it sounds very touchy-feely and almost New Age, but in fact, it's steeped in some basic biology and chemistry and physics, that the Earth system does have mechanisms, homeostatic mechanisms, if you will, that actually maintain it within a range that is suitable for life in the first place. So life actually acts in a way that maintains the Earth within a range that is suitable for life itself. It's a profound observation, and it's a truism at some level. And one can sort of use this almost as a metaphor. If Earth is subject to a virus, then its immune response, in a sense, will act in a way to try to destroy that virus. And the worry is that we, at times, almost act like a virus. We destroy the face of Gaia, the skin of Gaia, that is the surface. We're destroying the structural integrity of ecosystems, deforesting the Earth. And in some general sense, the Earth does have mechanisms to try to strike back at those insults. And one might imagine that pandemics, in a sense, could be envisioned as sort of the Earth system fighting back. Now, that is, it's a stretch, but I think it's useful as a metaphor. And the metaphor is that we have a choice. We can behave like the virus and force the immune system of the Earth to strike back, or we can behave synergistically with the Earth. And I think that this pandemic has really sort of allowed us to maybe a deeper understanding of basic issues of sustainability. Can we live sustainably on this planet? Can we change our way of living and doing things so that we're not essentially destroying our planetary home? Ultimately, we need to do that. If we continue on this course, if we continue our sort of unrestrained use of natural resources, exploitation of resources, and continue on with the carbon pollution that is ultimately leading us in the direction of catastrophic climate change, we will pay the price. But we do have agency. There is still time to make choices that take us on a different trajectory, a sustainable trajectory. And I hope that that is one of the key lessons we take away from this pandemic.
Well, it is interesting to look at how imperfectly, but certainly how the country and the world is trying to manage this COVID-19 outbreak. And we do see that we are turning to science, and we are turning to scientists and people that, like yourself, to be perfectly honest with you, at least when it comes to climate change, have been sounding the alarm for some time now. And it's always painful to think that you're right when the world is going through such a different, a difficult catastrophe. But nonetheless, do you see that we're actually, we want to hear what scientists have to say?
Yeah, but again, I see the same conflict that we see with climate change, where powerful vested interests have worked hard to discredit the science of climate change, and they've worked hard to confuse the public and to polarize the public when it comes to this science. Polarize the public against trust in scientists. It serves the interest of powerful fossil fuel companies that don't want to see us decarbonize our economy, that are very happy with the, you know, ongoing record profits that they get from our dependence on fossil fuels. But we're seeing some of the same actors, some of the same groups, many of the same individuals, high-profile climate change, industry-funded climate change deniers who have worked hard to discredit the science of climate change are out there trying to discredit the threat of COVID-19, of coronavirus. And the underlying reason is the same. At a very basic level, the lockdown that is necessary to avert a crisis in this case is going to hurt short-term economic growth. It's going to hurt the fossil fuel industry in particular. It's going to hurt the political chances, potentially, of fossil fuel-friendly demagogues like President Donald Trump, who's worked very hard to try to dismiss the threat of the pandemic. He initially called it a hoax. If you may remember that he's also dismissed climate change as a hoax. And that's so what we're seeing play out almost at an accelerated timescale. On an accelerated timescale is the same process of denial and delay that we've seen with climate change happening in some quarters when it comes to the pandemic. Here's the difference. We can see the cost of denial playing out in real time, and the cost of delay, the fact that the United States did not take meaningful action for more than a month, has put us on a trajectory where we're seeing more deaths and a greater rise in both cases and deaths in this country now than in any other country. And so, in a sense, anti-science and the cost of science denial has been laid bare by this episode. And maybe that's one of the lessons that we'll take away as well, the cost, the very real cost of science denial.
Well, laid bare and also put people's lives potentially at risk.
Absolutely. There are no doubt numerous deaths, loss of life in this case, that can be attributed specifically to the choices that were made by the Trump administration early on to not lock down in the same way other countries did. When this started, I was down in Australia, and Australia has taken far more proactive measures. Their neighbor, New Zealand, is a shining example of how a pandemic like this should be handled, of how policymakers like the New Zealand Prime Minister have been guided by science and acted in time to avert a catastrophe. And so there is a lesson there. If you follow what the science has to say, then you can avert death and destruction. And New Zealand has done it. Australia has done a much better job. The United States has probably done the worst job of any major nation.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Michael Mann. He's a professor of atmospheric science, director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. And we are talking about some of the parallels between COVID-19 and climate change. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. Elizabeth emailed, with pollution rates so far down, we have a sneak preview of life with less fossil fuels, but Trump wants to bail them out. This is the golden moment to switch gears and switch from the fossil fuel industry to renewables, something that you were saying earlier, Michael Mann. Yep. And I think oftentimes, at least in the past, we have the choices been between jobs or the economy and the environment. And I think the question is, can we figure out how we can get people back to work? And if you've got 15 or 20% of the population not working, that is a serious crisis that has to be addressed. But can you do that and also not go back to our sort of bad old ways?
No, exactly. The great question, and it ties in beautifully to what we were talking about before. The challenge is to decarbonize our economy. We can continue to maintain the health and vitality of the economy without generating carbon pollution if we can get off fossil fuels. And indeed, this latest episode has demonstrated that it is possible to lower carbon emissions, but there's a limit on that. We've only seen about a 4% decrease despite the pretty dramatic slowdown in economic activity. The fact that we've brought air travel to nearly a screeching halt, much less ground transportation. We're not driving as much. All of these things have not been enough to make a major dent in carbon emissions, only about a 4% dent. And that means that we need a much more fundamental transformation, which is getting off fossil fuels. And this is a golden opportunity, as the as the questioner alludes to. This is a golden opportunity to do that. Look, one of the things that this pandemic has sort of exposed is how fragile our infrastructure is, how dependent we are on fragile infrastructure, and how dramatically our lives can change when that infrastructure is subject to a shock be it the shock of this pandemic or the longer term, but every bit as much severe shock of human-caused climate change. And one of the ways that we decrease our vulnerability, our exposure to these sorts of shocks, is, for example, by decentralizing our access to energy, moving away from a fossil fuel industry driven power grid to decentralized sources of renewable energy and wind and solar. You know, even if fossil fuel infrastructure collapses, and we are seeing disruption of the fossil fuel supply chain, decreased production, transportation has been impacted. And so there is this vulnerability when we rely upon, you know, access to, you know, fossil fuels from other countries. One of the ways to decrease that vulnerability is to, again, to decentralize our access to energy, to get off fossil fuels, because no matter what happens to the production and distribution of oil and coal and natural gas, the wind will still be blowing, the sun will still be shining.
You promise?
Well, you know, at least for the foreseeable future, billions of years from now, it's a different ballgame.
I mean, you can understand the worry, and we're almost up in a break here, but just the worry that it's both an environmental worry, but the more sort of immediate worry, which is how are we going to get our life back again?
Yeah, no, that's right. And it's amazing how quickly we adjust to sort of the constraints that we're given, isn't it? I mean, our such fundamental shifts now in the way we're living our lives, and that's good news. It means that we can change our ways. I think that's one of the lessons to draw from this experience.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, Michael Mann is our guest. He's a professor of atmospheric science. He's director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. He's written a number of books about the climate. He's got a new one coming out called How to Win the New Climate War. And again, you can join our conversation sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, tweeting us at @WHYYRadioTimes, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, talking with our guest Michael Mann about whether we can apply lessons we are learning from handling the pandemic to the climate crisis, also talking about how mistrust in science has gotten in the way of both the climate and coronavirus emergencies, and we're looking at the impact that stay-at-home orders have had on limiting our lives, but also the impact on the environment. And again, you can join us, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I want to read something that I read from Ban Ki-moon, former UN Secretary General, but Michael, it speaks to what you were talking about, but yeah. I also think it's really beautifully eloquent. He says, if nature is sending us a message, what is it saying? It's telling us that we need to heal the planet if we want to heal ourselves, that we must be respectful of the boundaries between humans and other species, that we need to adapt and alter our behavior. And while we make these changes, we need to build our society's resilience to emergencies of all kinds, because our current planning and preparation for viruses, for rising seas, and other effects of climate change are not enough. And I'm sure you agree 100% with what he said, but I thought it was beautifully and concisely written.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a nice, concise summary of what we were just talking about, you know, the real lessons to draw from this. And look, you know, we have to be careful when, you know, we sort of frame this problem in terms of the destructive role of human beings, the potentially destructive role. As I said, one could imagine, one could be forgiven for using the sort of Gaian principle to think about this as, again, us destroying the environment, deforestation, pollution, including carbon pollution, all of the insults that we are subjecting the Earth to, and as we, you know, as those insults multiply geometrically as we expand our, the depletion of resources. Increasingly, destructive practices like blowing up mountaintops to get at the coal beneath or mining oil at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, which, as we saw, tragically led to a leak that destroyed the sort of the entire ecosystem. Certainly, it's still recovering from the Deep Horizon oil disaster, and now up in the Arctic, drilling in the Arctic, which again, it's this unique ecosystem that is at risk because of our practices. And so one could think about this as, human activity sort of being the virus and the organism of the earth striking back in the form of, pandemics. It's a fraught framing because it potentially buys into sort of what you might call an eco-fascist view.
Yeah, I hear that.
of human civilization. And the reality is that unlike a virus, we have a choice. We are sentient, unlike a virus, and we have a choice. We can behave like a virus, or we can behave much more like a symbiote, an organism that lives symbiotically with its environment. We have the choice to decide which we want to be, and as that statement so eloquently speaks to, perhaps we can use this moment to try to steer in the right path. The path of a synergistic relationship with our environment, which includes, of course, getting off fossil fuels, decarbonizing our economy so that we don't subject the planet to catastrophic climate change.
Let me read a tweet from Linda who says green jobs kind of depend on what opens and what is funded when things start to open up again. And obviously, we're not going to change fossil fuel cars overnight, but there are electric cars, there are other forms of transportation that it seems could be developed, although we heard from our first guest who covers the environment for Mother Jones, is that the Trump administration is doing what it can in the next couple of weeks to roll back a number of things like CAFE standards related to automobile emissions.
Yeah, I enjoyed Rebecca Lieber's comments. I thought they were very much on point. We have a choice. Because as we speak, and as she alluded to, fossil fuel interests are doing everything they can to actually exploit this moment, to try to pass through policies the Trump administration has been, while we've been distracted by COVID-19, the administration has been greenlighting various policies, executive actions to further dismantle environmental protections, further provide fossil fuel interests with incentives, including assistance in the construction of pipelines that will the construction of pipelines that commit us to basic fossil fuel infrastructure for decades. And so what we have to make sure is that the special interests whose agenda is currently being pushed by, plutocrats and autocrats like Donald Trump, that we don't allow them to take advantage of this moment, that we instead use this moment to fundamentally rethink our addiction, our reliance on fossil fuels. And, this is, there are changes in behavior that we've been forced to make because of the response to this pandemic that might actually be helpful. We've seen that we don't have to travel as much. We've seen that we can actually conduct conferences and interactions with other people, teaching. We can do that online. We don't have to, drive to school to do that. There are things that we are uncovering as we're forced to make these behavioral changes. There are lessons that we may take away that will allow us to be more less energy intensive, to be more efficient in our use of resources in the future. And I think some of that will stick. Yeah, we will return to, you know, sort of normal life to some extent as this mm-hmm. crisis passes. But I think some of the changes that we were required to make will stick with us, and that's a good thing. And maybe it'll help us get on that path that we need to get on.
I was also thinking some of the parallels. You mentioned this earlier. Obviously, both these crises, whether it's COVID-19 or climate change, depends on individual actions. What people do matters. It also depends on what the federal government either does or doesn't do. But I'm also thinking that a lot of where the action is when it comes to the environment is at the state and local level. That's where you're seeing a lot of innovation. And that's also true with this COVID-19. It's the states who seem to be, I mean, they are on the front lines, but nonetheless, that's where we're seeing a lot of the response to this particular COVID-19 crisis.
That's true, but make no mistake, that's in part true because we have a total lack of leadership. In fact, we have administration that is acting disadvantageously when it comes to their handling of this crisis. And so it's that vacuum, that lack of the leadership that we really need at the federal level that is requiring states and localities to take matters into their own hand. And fortunately, they're doing that. And there's so many sort of heroic efforts that we can speak to with governors like Cuomo and Gavin Newsom, who have taken real leadership in the absence of any federal leadership on this crisis. Now, ultimately, for example, when it comes to climate change and the mm-hmm. reduction in carbon emissions that are necessary, individual action, of course, that's important. There are things that we can all do to decrease our individual carbon footprints, and we should do those things. And states and localities can act and have acted and have passed measures to try to decrease our dependence on fossil fuels and improve energy efficiency. But that only gets us so far. If we are to achieve the monumental reductions we have to see now, we have to drop those carbon emissions by a factor of two by the end of this decade if we're going to maintain, stay on a path that limits warming below dangerous levels. To do that, we are absolutely going to need leadership at the international level in the form of international treaties and agreements like the Paris Accord that get us on the right path, but we've got to go farther than that. Paris isn't enough to limit warming below dangerous levels, and so we're going to continue to need those international treaties and agreements that require the good faith participation of all nations, including the leading industrial nations, including the world's largest carbon emitters. And we're one of the two largest carbon emitters, and yet under the current administration, we have played a destructive role in those international negotiations. Here's the good news. We've got less than a year to make a major change in direction. We can choose to elect a president and members of Congress who will act on our behalf rather than on behalf of the fossil fuel interests, and who help us get back on course to lead when it comes to the international effort to limit our carbon emissions. And so people need to think about that as they go to the voting booth in this next election, and not just president, but all the way down the ticket. Make sure that you think about climate change and sustainability when you vote.
Let me read a couple of more emails. One from Terry. Michael, this is kind of long. Michael says that if we decarbonize the economy, all will be good. But what about the depleting rivers, lakes, and aquifers, the decimated ocean fisheries, the clear cutting, the deforestation? And he goes on from there. I mean, obviously, fossil fuels is a piece of what we need to address. But as Terry says, there are many more intersecting responsibilities.
Oh, absolutely. And I sort of alluded to that. You know, we have to live more sustainably on this planet, and that includes reducing pollution, including carbon pollution. So I tried to maintain that broader perspective while obviously focusing, you know, mostly on climate change in this conversation. But there's no question there's a larger conversation that we have to have about how we live sustainably on this planet. And climate change, you know, the scientist in me likes to sometimes think in abstract ways. And I think of this as a multidimensional space. It's more than three dimensions. There are many different dimensions, and there are different axes that you can move along in those dimensions. in that space. There are different dimensions, and one of them is climate change. So climate change is just one axis in this many-dimensional problem, which is environmental sustainability. And so there's no question, even if we tackle the climate crisis, we have to still think about, the resource dependent, the extraction dependent economy that we still live within. If we decarbonize the economy, but we're still, massively extracting resources to generate renewable energy, because after all, wind turbines and solar panels, all of these things require the extraction of resources. It's unclear that there is a path that ultimately leads to sustainability, a sustainable existence on this planet that requires continued extraction of resources. And so we do ultimately have to solve that larger problem. We can't solve all the world's problems within the next 10 years.
No.
And climate change is a problem where if we don't act dramatically within the next 10 years, then we're committed to catastrophic impacts. And so that's why I focus so much on the near-term threat of the climate crisis. But make no mistake, there is a larger challenge that we have to face when it comes to living sustainably on this planet.
Here's an email from Mary. She says, as our permafrost melts, we will confront ancient microbes to which we've never been exposed. Could these microbes also pose a threat? You think so?
Yeah, I think we all saw that sci-fi film.
Exactly.
I think that's been the theme of, it is a potential threat. It's not the, there are enough sort of potential surprises, nasty surprises that lurk in sort of the greenhouse as we continue to warm the planet, that do keep me up at night. But that one, there are enough nasty microbes that are already out there, and the small number of additional microbes that will be released as the as the ice melts. To me, that's not the thing that keeps me up at night. There are too many other things that do.
Well, I think I'll want to, and we're trying to make connections. It's imperfect, but connections between COVID-19 and climate change. But the idea that prevention is better than the cure. I mean, it's been described as a kind of sledgehammer approach now that we're all hunkered down at home versus a more scalpeled approach, which would have prevented some of the misery that we're seeing. True for climate change, too, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. An ounce of prevention, as they say, right? And in this case, if we hadn't been undermining the integrity of natural ecosystems and tropical forests, we might not have seen the emergence of some of these pandemics that we've been subject to and these dangerous pathogens that we've been subject to. And so maintaining the health of our planetary environment solves so many other problems. And it's clearly the case with climate change. If we had acted on this problem decades ago, when we knew we had a problem, when ExxonMobil's own internal documents referred to the potential threat of climate change as catastrophic, those were the words of fossil fuel giant ExxonMobil back in the 1970s. If we had acted on the problem then, we would have avoided so much damage and death and destruction, and it would have been a much smoother ride to decarbonizing our economy. It would have been a gentle bunny slope. Instead, when it comes to the carbon emissions, how dramatically we have to bring them down now, we've got to go down a black double diamond slope. Because of the time that we've lost, because of the opportunity that we've lost due to delay that was mostly bought by a disinformation campaign by fossil fuel interests.
I've been down black double diamond slopes. They are scary as hell, Michael
Mann. That's right.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Mari.
Always a pleasure to have you with us. And he's a professor of atmospheric science, director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. And he's got a new book coming out called How to Win the New Climate War. And we began with Rebecca Lieber, reporter for Mother Jones, who covers environmental policies and politics. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Al Bank's the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moskowing. Thanks for joining us.